You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Today's podcast is with Ron Friedman. Ron is an award-winning psychologist who helps leaders build high-performance teams. He is the best-selling author of The Best Place to Work and Decoding Greatness. And he's the founder of Super Teams, Inc., where he delivers keynotes, workshops, and executive advisory services to senior leaders around the world. He has a new book. It's called Super Teams, The Science and Secrets of High-Performing Teams. Enjoy the pod. Ron Friedman, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. Great to be here.
In the conclusion of your new book, you write that, quote, "Humans didn't evolve to work alone. We're wired to connect, collaborate, and excel within small, tightly knit groups," end quote. And one of the examples you cite, somewhat surprisingly when I was first reading it, is lottery winners. How do lottery winners provide an example of this idea?
There's a remarkable amount of research on what leads lottery winners to go back to their job even after they've won hundreds of millions of dollars. And as it turns out, the primary reason that determines whether people go back is how rewarding they find their job. And so the question is, what makes a job rewarding? And it's not what most people think. It's not the salary. It's not the title. It's not the perks. The thing that drives people to return to work is being part of a great team and doing great work with great people. And that's what I was determined to study in Super Teams, is what are the factors that actually drive team performance and make a job really rewarding?
So I did this thing. I think many of us do this thing where I fantasize, but what if someone gave me, $500 million? What would I do? And first I was like fixing up the house. I was thinking about travel. And my wife's like, "Would you quit work?" And I was like, "No, I wouldn't." I thought about it. It's like, no, I really like what I do. People are my oxygen. But also this lineage at Second City, we've been around 67 years. We have these stages where you have six people improvise nightly with audiences. They become an ensemble, is what they are and what they call themselves. And everything they've learned is about things like, hey, you have to make your partner look good. You have to listen to everything someone says. Everything they say is right, and you build upon that. And as I'm reading through your book about teams, oh, and by the way, it's not comfortable. You know, it's not easy. In fact, discord is built in. And it was like, oh, this seems very akin to the things you write about in the book.
That's exactly right. So let me tell you a little bit about how we did the study, just to bring the listeners in. So we interviewed over 6,000 individuals who work on teams, and we asked them two simple questions with regard to their team. Number one, how effective is your team at achieving its goals? And number two, compared to other teams in your industry, how would you rate your team's performance? And then we took the teams with a perfect score, a small group, we call them super teams, and we looked to see what do the super teams do differently. And as you correctly point out, one of the key differences about super teams is that they don't just collaborate well, they make each other better. That's one of the key strengths. The other two strengths that define them is that they get more done by better managing their time, energy, and attention. And thirdly, even when things are going well, they're consistently looking for ways to get better. They're building new skills. They're improving over time. And we could talk about how they do that. But to me, the most inspiring message of all is that each and every one of those strengths is learnable, which means by building the right habits, any team can dramatically improve its performance. And it's by studying teams like the ones you have at Second City.
So a thought experiment opens this book wherein you ask us to imagine mysterious fire destroying your office, which actually happened to me. That's another story. Second City caught on fire like 10 years ago, and my office and many offices were completely destroyed.
Oh, no.
but it was liberating in many ways, and we'll get into it. But for the purpose of this conversation, you give a list of ideal workplace design elements that we can pick from, and the list has everything from skylights to ping pong tables. Can I tell you what I picked? I didn't read ahead, and I was wrong, but not completely. I picked three. Collaborative spaces for group work, private meeting rooms for confidential conversations. No, I picked four. Skylights and a quiet workspace for focused work. So I picked those four. Mm-hmm. But the answer is one, right?
Yeah. So we, in our research, we put these amenities in front of people and we said, which do you actually have in your office? And we were interested in learning what are the factors that actually position a team to succeed? What are the factors that truly define super teams? And as it turned out, only one amenity actually made a difference. And it wasn't the ping pong table. It wasn't the office dog. It wasn't the heated toilet seats that they have at Google. What really drove performance was having a quiet space to do focus work. And what I think that tells us is how most offices today have become attentional war zones. And it's why so many people prefer to work from home. It's the only way for them to actually feel like they can get work done. And if you want a team to be successful, you have to create both the time and the space for them to do productive work. And part of being an effective collaborator is having the opportunity to do your individual part by working alone. And when we think about collaboration, everyone says they want more collaboration, but what they don't realize is that they're conflating collaboration with constant togetherness. And constant togetherness isn't what defines a high performing team.
So this is what I was thinking about with regard to Second City, which is, you know, it's live. You are together in a room, all that stuff. However, it is for a specific time. Like, rehearsals rarely go over 3 hours. The show itself is about an hour and a half, not an hour and 45 minutes. And then you do go home, and often the director gives writing assignments that you're going to come in, and then you're also going to collaborate. So it is an immense amount of structure, and the together time is actually fairly small, because in essence, what we also know is very creative people need time to incubate their ideas and find their ideas. And they find that by going to the Starbucks and interacting with someone, or by walking around, or in a variety of other ways. So it's not that the success is because we're live. Live is an element of that. And you even talk about this in the book with regard to remote work. It's like, that's not the point in terms of like whether it's home or whether it's here. It's how you work.
Exactly right. So that's another part of what we had discovered in the research for super teams is we looked at where are these high performing teams located? Are they more likely to form in the office? Are they more likely to form working remotely? Or maybe it's the best of both worlds. Maybe the ideal situation is just being hybrid. And as it turns out, the location didn't matter. It didn't predict the frequency of high performing teams. What mattered more than location was how the team worked. You can have people together in an office, but if all they're doing is getting on Zoom, that's not going to fulfill the promise of high performing teams. That's going to build resentment and burnout, because people are commuting 2 hours just to get on a Zoom they could have attended from home. Taking advantage of what togetherness has to offer, it requires intention. It requires planning. A good example is saying, okay, look, we're going to leave it to you to figure out where you work best. But on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we're going to have strategic conversations. So get all your pre-reads in on Friday afternoon so people can show up to be prepared to contribute. That's taking advantage of the best of what we can get from being together. And so it requires a little bit of planning. The other thing I would say is, you know, on the point of constant togetherness, you know, one of my favorite examples of how we get this wrong is the quintessential teamwork example is, let's all brainstorm together. Everybody get into the conference room. We're all going to throw up ideas and we'll come up with some great solutions. And what the research tells us is that, in fact, if you want high frequency of ideas and higher quality ideas, you're far better off doing brain writing instead of brainstorming. And brain writing is simply a psychological term that means we're going to take turns individually coming up with ideas alone in our offices, and then we're going to get together in the conference room to exchange ideas and fine-tune the ones that we developed. The challenge with brainstorming is that the first person who speaks tends to anchor people around their suggestion. And then instead of contributing our own ideas, we're simply evaluating the first person who spoke. The other thing that happens is we all kind of feel this diffusion of responsibility, because even if we're not contributing ideas, we all feel like we've been part of a meeting that came up with multiple ideas. But when you're sitting there alone in your office, when you have an empty list, you can't help but feel that pain, and that drives you to contribute more. And so just a great example of how, if we want creative ideas, we really need to build in that time for individual work as well as being together.
So I've had this argument about this idea with Nick Epley, who's a professor at the University of Chicago, because I'm aware of the research. There is an antidote to that problem, and it's yes and. So when someone, if you're taught as an improviser that you're going to take the idea that someone said, say yes to it and add to it, and then their job is to say yes and add to that, you do avoid that sort of groupthink idea.
Kelly, can I push back on this?
Sure.
This is great. I finally get to speak to someone who is an expert on this, because yes. I've been in those meetings where you have the yes and the people have been trained to say yes and I think sometimes the idea is just bad. Is it possible the idea is just bad and I don't want to build
absolutely.
On it?
Well, absolutely. But what we understand is that bad ideas can often be the source for later great ideas.
That's true.
Especially in the world of comedy.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, you want like bad or outrageous. If something is going to be innovative, it's probably going to look unusual, weird, problematic. And the thing about yes and that we stress to our folks when we go into corporate situations is it's about abundance at the beginning. Mm. We have a 12-week process for creating a show. Yes and is the first 4 weeks. It's like we want as much stuff to draw on as possible. After that, we are honing, editing, and then my wife just directed the latest show here, and the last three shows, they did, she goes, okay, I'm going to allow a public funeral for your scenes that didn't make it. So she actually put these terrible scenes in the show for them to die one last death. And actually, I think those kinds of ceremonies and rites actually make people feel better about letting go of a thing. I mean, I think this is a situation where we're both right, which is if you're not trained in doing this kind of, work with regard to allowing a space for the bad idea to exist a little bit, that can become a real problem, especially if there's status stuff going on in that room. If the bad idea is coming from the CEO.
Great point about the status. Great point, because I think that is one of the barriers. And I will say, I appreciate your point very much. And I think that maybe the solution is the best of both worlds, which is having people come up with the ideas individually and then present them to the group. And then yes, anding around the finished product where they've had a little bit of time to think about their ideas as opposed to just being put on the spot and coming up with the best idea they can come up with in that moment.
Well, and then the other aspect of it, which is the scientific method, is it's not up to us. It's up to the audience. Mm-hmm. So then you're going to put it up in front of an audience. And if no one is laughing, it's like, well, that we all know where that's going, because the one thing is it's got to be funny. And not that there's not a place for a groan, not that there's not a place for something that's a little bit serious or whatever, but that and what I recognize is that in a lot of businesses, well, this is changing. I was going to say, in a lot of businesses, you don't have the opportunity to test your ideas out. But I think now we live in a world where you can. There's prototyping opportunities that just never existed in the business world that now you can do on a website or, on a podcast or, flash up a menu item and see what people are saying. And what a great gift that could inspire a whole another load of research.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the elements that we find that differentiates high-performing teams is that they are experimenting 48% more often than average teams. And it's a big part of how they continuously get better, because unless you're experimenting with new ideas, there's just no opportunity for getting better. And one of the things we know about experimentation is it doesn't happen unless people feel safe doing it. And it really is the job of the leaders to create that psychological safety. And we find a number of ways in which the best leaders kind of create that safety. And one of my favorite insights from the book is that we find that high performing leaders tend to talk more about the failures they've encountered along the way. And that makes it safe for people to admit their own mistakes and also sends a signal that mistakes aren't something to hide. There's something to learn from. And unless people feel that safety around learning, growth simply can't happen.
Here's one more thing. Do you want to guess how many people are in the ideal number for a number of people in a Second City cast?
Is it seven?
It's six.
Ha!
Huh. So let's talk about that, because I've seen this research before, and I'll just, you had this Bain study that found for every person beyond seven, decision quality drops by 10%.
Yes.
completely true in my experience.
Completely. And the reason that is the case is because what ends up happening is the more people you have in the room, the more voices need to be heard, and the more likely you are to go off track from the thing that actually matters. And, you know, I think it's obvious to everyone that inviting people who can't contribute to the meeting is a waste of their time. What's less obvious is that having those people in the room makes the meeting worse for the people who actually need to be there. And so one of the strategies we talk about in super teams is limiting invitations. We find that super teams are 50% better at avoiding unnecessary meetings. They're 54% less likely to schedule recurring meetings. They just do a whole slew of things that take apart the biggest time sink in people's week, and that's constant meetings. The average worker spends 18 hours a week in meetings. That's half their week gone before they've achieved a single task.
So, why? Why do people call so many meetings? And I know there's a few answers to this, and they're not all pretty. You double down hard on this. I mean, I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that you would probably prefer that you have 0 to 1 or 2 meetings a week and not more than that.
I mean, well, look, one of the things that I love is just looking at the research. That's part of what I do energizes me, is because I don't have to pretend that I have all the answers, but I can do the research and uncover the answers. And what we know from the research is that having at least 2 meeting-free days a week tends to elevate people's performance. Organizations that have experimented with 2 meeting-free days per week tend to have higher productivity, lower stress, greater satisfaction among their employees. And you asked, why are meetings so common? I think part of it is the culture. Part of it is we've inherited a culture of consensus where we feel like we need to have everybody sign off on everything. And in reality, what ends up happening when people feel that they have to constantly be in meetings is not only do they get burnt out, they become resentful. They try to take back their time. And how do you take back your time? Either you come in early and stay late, or you multitask. And both of those avenues undermine productivity and performance and actually lead to more burnout. And so I think we're far better off studying what these super teams are doing, which is they're protecting people's time during the day so that they can get real work done without having to worry about it in the evenings and weekends.
I meant to ask this earlier. Let's double click on constant communication. When I have attempted to list out all the different ways that people communicate to me in my business, and I worked at Second City before the internet was a thing, or is just becoming a thing, it's kind of shocking. So we've got email, we've got text, we've got Teams, we've got Slack, we've got LinkedIn, we've got Facebook Messenger. I just got texted from a publicist. I'm like, how did you, first of all, find my private mobile number to text me about a quote for an article or whatever? I mean, it's got to be 20, 25 different ways that people, and we're not built to like handle that, are we?
Yeah, it's the constant distraction not only is problematic from the sake of dividing our attention in the moment, but there's also attention residue, which we experience. And that's just a term that represents how when you move to the second meeting after the first meeting, part of your brain is still replaying what happened in that first meeting. And the more meetings you take, the more attention residue you accumulate, and the more mistakes you make as the day progresses. And so we really need to be intentional about how we divide up our time during the day. And in the book, I talk about strategies that super teams use and individuals on super teams use. So I'll give you an example of two. Mm-hmm. In the case of the team level, and this, by the way, I think is perhaps, to me, one of the most satisfying insights in the book, which is productivity tips, the things that we have been taught to do to protect our time and attention during the day, things like turning off notifications and only checking your email 3 times a day. Those productivity tips turn out to slow down the team. And it's because when one person unilaterally decides they're not going to be available to the people on their team, they create bottlenecks. And so far from protecting our time and attention, what we end up doing is lengthening the workday for everyone. So we really need to be thinking about this on the team level. And that brings me to the second strategy that I wanted to talk about, which is meeting guidelines. This is one of the quickest ways to eliminate unnecessary meetings, meeting guidelines. So what are meeting guidelines? They're basically just simply rules that the team comes up with about what justifies a meeting and what doesn't. So on my team, we have a simple rule: no decisions, no meeting. And that, mm-hmm. unless there's a decision to be made, we're not going to pull people away from their work. If you have an update, great, send an email. If you have a question, pick up the phone. Another example is from the content marketing company Percolate. They have a meeting guideline that says no spectators. And that speaks to what we were just referencing earlier about how the more people you have in the room, the longer the meeting. There's also a meeting guideline I talk about that was taken from the Obama White House about having 15-minute meetings. So if you need longer, you can have it, but you need to get the approval from the team's leader. All of these practices ensure, again, that people are enabled to do real work during regular work hours without having it bleed over to their personal time.
There's this improv exercise that we use when we're working in different corporate groups called 60-30-10. And the exercise is we pair people up and we're like, okay, you guys are going to have a conversation. And we do it in many different ways, but it's like you want to talk about some accomplishment that you experienced that you want someone else to know about. And you're going to do 60 seconds to do that. And then we're going to have you do it again, but you're going to do it in 30 seconds. And then we're going to have you do it again, and you're going to do it in 10 seconds. And we were doing a workshop in D.C., and this was during the Obama administration, and someone raised their hand because it was Ash Carter's wife. And she's like, that's what you learn when you go into the Oval. Like, literally, you don't know what your period is going to be, that you might have the 10 seconds, so you have to figure out how to say the important thing. And we're like, well, that's just true across the board. You never know. So this idea of like recognizing the context of the time you're in, also the importance. And what you might figure out when you get to the 10 seconds is that thing wasn't that important in the first place.
I love that. That's really interesting because what you're doing is you're enabling people to learn in real time. And so that's exactly what we try to do in our workshops. It is really remarkable how when you have people do this in a group, not only do you have deeper learning, but you foster that collaboration, which I'm sure you see in your workshops as well.
Yeah, totally. You write in the book, quote, and then there's laughter. A stunning 87% of super teams report laughing with colleagues often, and that's 55% higher than average teams. Well, this is music to my ears. Why? Why do you think laughter is so important?
It's because they genuinely enjoy working together. And so it's not by telling each other more jokes. It's by creating those bonds and relationships where people genuinely respect and like one another. And one of the things we talk about in the book is how that isn't fostered by more icebreakers and more trust falls. If you really want to develop a close relationship with someone, look for ways to contribute to their success, whether it's at work or outside of work. That's how you develop those real relationships. And then you can broaden it out by talking about what you have in common and your shared interests and, you know, what happened last night's soccer game or whatever the case may be. But it close relationships don't build around those elevator conversations. It's really by contributing to other people's success. And that's how we find that super teams make one another better. It's because they're constantly looking for ways to contribute to one another's success.
And I think they're not telling jokes in terms of the laughter. What they're probably doing is self-disclosing, sharing stories about themselves that are amusing. And can you talk about that exercise? Because I love the fact that you felt a little uncomfortable about doing that exercise at the top of the meeting where you'd share something, thinking it might be like hokey or whatever. But it worked, right?
Yeah. So there's an exercise in the book I talk about, which is, it's kind of an icebreaker, frankly, where if you do this, I refer to it as a team ritual because it's not something you do in an offsite. It's a kickoff for when you have a team meeting. And when we think about the value of good meetings, they don't just draw us closer to solving problems. They also draw us closer to our teammates. And so a great way of doing that is asking a question at the top, something like, you know, if you were trapped on a desert island, and you had to listen to just one artist, who would that artist be? And you go around the room and everyone answers within a number of seconds. And you learn about your teammates. You also maybe are exposed to new musical genres you hadn't even encountered before. But what it does is it gets everyone smiling in the first 2 minutes of the meeting. And what we know from the research is if you want people to be creative, you want them to be in a good mood. And so there's this classic research study where at the beginning of the study, they gave people a candy. And then they had them do a creative exercise. And people who were given a candy, because they were put through a good mood, this wasn't a carbohydrate infusion. It was actually because of the mood. They did a test to determine that was the case. When people were in a good mood, they came up with more creative solutions. And part of it is when we are less stressed, we can think more broadly and look for more loose connections that contribute to better ideas.
Yeah. And this is Epley's research is all about the power of self-disclosure, but even more so how unwilling we often are to self-disclose because we don't think people care or are interested, or we think it's going to be embarrassing. And it rarely is. People actually do enjoy. And then mirroring, we're reciprocal, all that stuff. All right. So chapter five, I hired Tina Fey at Second City. Gave her her first professional show. I also use her as an example in my talks that I give about someone who is an amazing leader, drawing on the rules of improvisation. I don't know Chevy Chase, but I know his reputation in the industry that I'm in. So I want you to talk a little bit about why Chevy Chase versus Tina Fey is this sort of like story in chapter five. And if you had any questions for me, I can certainly tell you what I know, because you are correct, sir.
Wow. Okay. Well, it's fascinating. Congratulations on your eye for talent, by the way, yep. Kelly. So the chapter five is about what the best teammates do differently. And it's about research that we conducted asking people to describe the best teammate they've ever had and the worst teammate they've ever had. And then we looked statistically at the factors that are consistent among the best teammates and the worst teammates. And what we found is there is remarkable consistency, regardless of whether we're talking to people who are on super teams or on average teams, about the factors that make the best teammates different. I'll go into those factors first, and then I'll talk about Chevy Chase and Tina Fey. So I'll start with the worst teammates first. The top three factors that distinguish the worst teammates for people is, number one, they were unreliable. Number two, they had a bad attitude. And number three, they were arrogant. Now, again, like Kelly, I don't know anything about Chevy Chase beyond what I've read in the news. However, most of his teammates would probably describe him using at least two out of three of those adjectives: unreliable, bad attitude, arrogant.
Completely. And anyone who saw his documentary knows that he even said that. That's true. Yep.
And so what about the best teammates? And so three factors, again, that stood out. Number one, they were knowledgeable. They're someone whose expertise the team could rely on. Number two, they were dependable. This is the opposite of the unreliable teammate. This is the person who you know has your back. They'll do what they said they were going to do. And finally, they're a good communicator. They're someone who shares information and keeps everyone in the loop. That and far more appear to describe Tina Fey. And so I tried to start every chapter in the book, I try to anchor it around a story that is relatable, memorable. I had a great editor for my first book who told me people will want the data, but what they'll remember is the stories. And so I've really taken that advice to heart. And so there are some great stories throughout the book, whether it be Tina Fey and Chevy Chase, to Guns N' Roses and ABBA, Def Leppard, Watson and Crick. I try to really keep people interested, not just educated. But anyway, with regard to Tina Fey and Chevy Chase, I tell the story of Chevy Chase's rise and fall. And then I end it by talking about how different Tina was and how she prioritized the team success over her personal career ambitions.
It's and some of that is time. Chevy certainly came up at a time when I think, you sort of thought to be a great comedic artist, you had to either be someone who's going to like die young, or had this sort of like arrogant streak. And I actually remember this very specifically. Mark Maron was here doing a talk, and I was touring him around the building, looking at all the pictures, and he had this epiphany. I was with him, and it's so fascinating. They had this epiphany. He's like, he's looking at it, he's like, Belushi died for his art, and John Candy died young, and blah, blah, all that. And then he gets to like Stephen Colbert. Oh, that guy's well adjusted. Steve Carell. Oh, he's a really good guy. Tina Fey. She's very together. And it sort of dawned on him is like none of the people in that modern era, and this is my era at Second City, were people who felt the need to burn out. Mm. And Tina in particular was someone who was always looking to elevate her ensemble mates. And I mean, she is single-handedly responsible for Rachel Dratch getting hired on Saturday Night Live, because they had actually said no. They flew out Rachel for a callback, said no. Tina got hired as a writer. And then the next season, Adam McKay, another Second City alum who was the head writer, stepped down, and they made Tina head writer of SNL her second season. And Tina actually called me and said, hey, I want to do a two-person show with Dratch at Second City this summer. Is that cool? And we had a slot, so we're like, yeah, that's great. And all this time, what Tina knew is that Lorne Michaels and the producers would come here to scout talent like they do every single summer, and they're not going to not see the show that Tina's in, which means they saw Rachel, and Lorne Michaels hired Rachel Dratch after that show.
That's a great story. And Amy Poehler as well, right? She's responsible for her bringing on the show.
Yeah, exactly. It's you know, and that's and what a golden era of Saturday Night Live that was, and Maya and other people who she wasn't necessarily responsible for, but this is what's fascinating about it, right? Is that all those people cared for each other, and the work was so good and so mm-hmm. funny, and I think there is there are previous generations which felt so. No, you have to be in Discord. Famously, Bill Murray got in fights with Chevy Chase and John Belushi didn't get along with anyone. And it's like, those guys were funny, but it didn't last.
Right. And what's noteworthy about Tina Fey bringing on those other female contributors is that there aren't that many roles necessarily for a female comedian. And so to bring on others at a time when many would have simply hogged the spotlight for themselves goes to speak to the personality and the kind of person you want on your team. And in the book, I also talk about how you can spot some of those characteristics when you're interviewing. And there's this great example of a company that has people present to other job applicants. So basically what they do is it's actually an airline, and the airline has people come up and present, you know, kind of talk about themselves for 2 minutes. And everyone in the room thinks they're having you do this because they want to know how well you speak. If you're going to be addressing the entire plane, they want to make sure that, you know, you can speak well. But in fact, what they're looking at is whether or not you're supportive of the other applicants when it's their turn to speak. And it's that kind of person who's going to be a great teammate, because they know even though it's a competitive situation, they're still interested in supporting others. And so I think we need to be thinking about this more strategically, because, you know, it's being a good contributor, being a good employee, and being a good teammate, those are completely different skills. And outside of sports, very few of us are actually ever taught how to be great teammates.
Yeah, it's basically the theater kids and the sports kids who had to, like, you know, come together as a team to accomplish a thing.
Right.
I guess like marching band, you know, I mean that seriously, because I know a bunch of people who are in marching bands who are really good. And it's like, and I think also synchrony probably helps with that too. There's some research around that.
And I'll just say, Kelly, if you'll allow me. I think one of the things I talk about in the introduction is how most teams aren't real teams. And what I mean by that is most people who belong to a team at work are simply just members of the same department. They don't really have that team mindset. And in order to establish that team mindset, there's a very clear formula that most organizations actually know nothing about. And you need three things. You need, number one is a shared goal. Everyone on the team needs to be pushing in the same direction for the same outcome. So if I'm interested in going home at 5 o'clock and you're interested in getting a promotion, we don't have a shared goal, and that's going to lead to tension. The second thing you need is role clarity. I need to know what I'm responsible for, and I need to know what you're responsible for, and I need to know how those two things intersect. If we don't have role clarity, we're either going to get dropped balls or we're going to have a turf war, and either one of those is problematic. And the third thing is you need interdependence, which is just a fancy psychological term that means we need to feel like we need each other to be successful. And you have each of those at Second City, right? You all have, you all want to make the show a success. You know what your role is, and you know you need each other to be successful. Unfortunately, most organizations, most people working at companies don't have that. And it's why they don't have a team mentality. And I talk about in the book, if you don't have one of these three things, you don't have a team. You have a recipe for dysfunction.
So it's so fascinating. And I wish this is something that I understood earlier in my career, that, everything we learned, like in kindergarten, is probably the thing that we should have kept doing, which is like, drink more water, write it down, you know, like be nice to each other. It's like, these are like, that will get you much farther than, you know, what you're potentially learning in your MBA. Talk about the competency trap. What is a competency trap?
The older we get, the more we kind of just stick to the things that we're good at. And if you want to grow, and you need to grow if you want to be psychologically satisfied with your job, you know, a lot of us feel like at a certain age, okay, we just want to be comfortable. But the reality is we all have a psychological need for what psychologists will call competence or mastery. And all that means is feeling good at what we do, but also having the ability to grow and build new skills and improve over time. Because if we're not growing, we're bored. And if we're getting bored, then that is not the recipe for engagement or high performance. And so ultimately, you need a team and you need a leader who pushes you to get better over time. Otherwise, you're going to get disengaged and you're going to look for growth, but it'll be outside the office.
It's interesting. I produced Second City from 1992 till around 2013, 2015, 2016, when I wrote the book Yes And. And then I stepped down. And I stepped down for, you know, I didn't love where things were going. But I think also there was certainly something internally that recognized, I don't know that I'm going to be happy doing the same thing over and over again. And luckily, I ended up doing this partnership at the University of Chicago, working with all these brilliant behavioral scientists. And I remember Heather Caruso, who's now at UCLA, saying to me, she goes, you did the classic thing, which is you become happy when you find an adjacent expertise. So, like, I wasn't out of my – I had done improv on stage, and then I moved to improv off stage. And so – and it was just different enough that it allowed me to still be competent and work in that. But it was different, and I challenged myself. And the reality was I could have kept doing the other thing, could have kept getting good reviews. I hired a lot of famous people, but it's like, it's not brain surgery to sit in a room and be like, hey, Stephen Colbert is hilarious. You know, it's like everyone knows that. So, I think that and Mary Murphy has been a guest on the podcast, and you talk a lot about her work around culture of growth, which is then, man, you've got to be able to risk. And it is, that's hard, especially when things are going well.
Yeah. But you know what? Part of having that ongoing development and ongoing growth is making it part of your culture. So in other words, we talked earlier about experimentation. And part of the leader's job is to spotlight people who are taking those risks and to direct the team's attention to people who are taking intelligent risks. Recently, my team and I just did a study that isn't in the book. It's about how high-performing teams use AI. Oh. And what we find is that average teams, people feel guilty about it. They hide it from one another. And they don't share anything they've learned. But on high-performing teams, they're far more open about sharing prompts with one another. And when they are sharing ideas that were AI-generated, they tell others that. And so what that does is it enables the entire group to continuously get better because they're constantly learning from one another's prompts. Whereas people who are on average teams, not only do they not share it, they actually feel like they're more in danger of losing their job because they're afraid that if they were to share what they've learned, there wouldn't be a need to have them on. And so when you look at the people who feel most insecure about losing their jobs to AI, they're the ones who don't feel like they're doing it as part of a team.
That's really interesting. I just had this experience. Our colleague was like, hey, to my colleague Jeremy and I, our friend Elizabeth was like, could you help me just move this thing over the goal line, which was around like tours of Second City for like young people or whatever. And I had actually written a script for this tour. And so Jeremy goes, come over to my office. He got clawed up. He's like, you have that script that you did? So we put, it's my work. Like, these are all my words. I also know AI has scraped every one of these podcasts. AI has scraped my book. AI has scraped all of your books. I can tell you that right now. Because you, like I, were probably offered some pittance by our publisher to say that it was okay, even though they'd already done it. Anyway, Jeremy and I sat in a room, and we came up with this. AI helped us get this thing to a place where we could send it to our in-house designer and say, we need just something like this. Mm-hmm. This is all the information in there you have, make it fit our brand style, all that. And I didn't feel I was cheating. I was totally fine saying this is how we did it. And I did not feel I was using someone else's work. I just needed help from like an assistant that I don't have.
It's funny because it sounds like you even though you said you didn't feel guilty doing it, I sense that part of you maybe felt a little bit guilty doing it.
Totally. Yes.
And you know what? I think what we're experiencing now is a dichotomy between people who are in business versus the ones who are creating businesses. And the ones who are creating businesses have no compunction about using any AI for anything because they've got nothing to lose. And so I think for the more established organizations, unless they are more intentional about creating this AI first mindset where not only is it allowed, but it's encouraged. And we want you to share your ideas because they're all going to get better together. You're going to fall behind. I mean, that's just the reality of it.
No, this is perfect because your book says this over and over and over again, which is be straight up about it. Give like, you know, make a policy, make sure people understand what it is and go forth and don't try to overcomplicate it. Because it is the world we live in, whether you like it or not. And the big thing I've been talking about here is like, I literally worked here when the internet got put in. And we had the first website of any theater in Chicago. When we did that, people were like, why are you doing this? You know, and now I look at it and go, oh, where does all the money come into the business? And it is through the internet. So You can't escape it.
Nope. Nope.
All right. This is perfect. We always ask the last question for a new guest on the podcast for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
So I opened the book, Super Teams, talking about this Silicon Valley company that approaches me about doing a study about teamwork. And I just had no idea where to take it. So eventually I said, yes, I'll do the study. And then I thought about this classic research on what happy people do differently. And it's, you know, you've probably encountered some form of this study where they studied happy people and compared them to people who are less happy and looked at what are the happy people doing differently. And they found all sorts of really interesting insights, like don't compare yourself to people who you consider to be more successful, and consider meditating and be express some gratitude on a daily basis. And that classic study is what led to this research on super teams, because basically what I did was I took that very idea of comparing happy versus unhappy people, except I replaced it with people on high performing versus on average teams. And that's what led to super teams, and never would have happened had I not taken that, that opportunity.
Yeah, you took a risk. The book is called Super Teams, The Science and Secrets of High Performance Teams. Ron Friedman, thanks for coming on the pod.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.